Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist, Season 2, with me, your host, Chloe Timms. Thank you for joining me for a new season where I speak to 2023's debut authors. I've got some amazing guests coming up who you'll hear from every Thursday. This week, I'm talking to Heather Darwent about her psychological suspense novel, The Things We Do to Our Friends, which has just become a Sunday Times bestseller. Heather is based just outside of Edinburgh. Originally from Yorkshire, she came to Scotland to study history of art at the University of Edinburgh, like her character Claire, and ended up never quite leaving. In this episode, we discuss what it's like to be a debut novelist with the added pressure of your book being compared to big, famous novels, her long journey to find an agent, including rewriting and resubmitting, and why patience is key during the publication process. But first, here's Heather with an excerpt from The Things We Do to Our Friends.
I've decided to look back and make some kind of sense of it all. And the initial idea of starting to put the pieces together in one place was because Tabitha's mother asked me to write it all down, so she had something of Tabitha's, a tangible record of her life with the extended family. But I couldn't quite bring myself to cobble together a fictional account where we were normal students who did normal things. So I ended up giving her a vague excuse, and she didn't ask again. But the idea wouldn't die down once you'd brought it up. And I thought, why not? Why shouldn't I go back over what happened for my own purposes? Then the question was, where does the tale begin? And although there are other places that may seem more logical, September 2005 feels about right. My arrival. How very dramatic that sounds, but it felt dramatic at the time. September is a month that has a special anticipation associated with it. As the leaves turn and the nights darken, the first time you crack open a book, cracking the spine and smoothing down the pages so they can't spring back up. It's a month that means fresh beginnings, and that only happens a few times in life when the slate is wiped clean and the story is ready for you to begin and tell it how you wish. The first day of a new job, when you're cautious and rule-abiding, or with a new partner when you share appealing parts of yourself to test the reaction. At university, it is even more of an opportunity. Nobody knows who you are. There are no expectations or preconceptions. How you answer each question and how you position yourself is entirely up to you. But it needs to begin somewhere. And for me, it was Edinburgh at Waverley Station.
Hi, Heather. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining me on the very first episode of Season 2 to talk about your novel, The Things We Do to Our Friends.
Hi, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So can you start by telling us what The Things We Do to Our Friends is about?
Sure. So The Things We Do to Our Friends is a dark psychological suspense, verging on thriller. It's set in Edinburgh and explores how far a group of university friends will go when they start this dangerous business. So readers can expect lots of despicable behaviour, lots of lies, secrets, and a little bit of murder.
Yeah, really great characters, some really dark behaviour. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the inspiration for this novel, because I was kind of, when I was reading it, I was wondering where it began, really, whether it was kind of, you started with the kind of themes you wanted to explore, or you started with the characters, or whether it was something else that kind of inspired this novel.
Yeah, so it came from lots of things, really. So I guess in some ways, and I think a lot of debut authors definitely have said this about writing their debut, in that you kind of end up taking quite a lot from your own life because you're kind of like, oh, just take that, that's easy. So in terms of like the setting and a lot of the kind of background, that was kind of from my own life. So I also studied history of art, like my protagonist Claire. I worked in a cocktail bar, like Claire. I have some links to France. I kind of took all that and then lots of the kind of, the setting of Edinburgh I was quite familiar with. So that was where the kind of inspiration came from. Obviously, all the characters are completely fictional. I have to do that caveat because they're awful. But yeah, and then it was really just like being in Edinburgh, and I think I was studying history of art, and there was definitely a sense of like I just didn't really like know what I was going to do when I graduated, really. I liked the course, but I wasn't sure how like that would lead into a job. It wasn't kind of immediately clear like what jobs you would do with that degree. And then that kind of got me thinking, this idea of like, making your own job, making your own life, what would that look like? I also kind of worked in startups for quite a few years, and that was kind of an inspiration, that idea of like startups definitely have that idea of kind of doing something new and taking on something and taking on a risk. I think that's a really interesting kind of mindset. So, as I said, the group kind of embark on this really ill-advised business. So that was really fun to write about. So that was kind of a roundabout way, but that's kind of where it all came from.
Yeah, I mean, I had a similar experience in the fact I can't say my book relates to my life that much, but in terms of kind of taking pieces from different areas of your interest or what kind of fascinates you and putting it together in a novel, and you've tied it together beautifully in this novel because it all fits together really well. I was wondering how it feels to kind of have your book comped to some big titles. So your novel has been described as this dark academia, which many people may know that that is kind of huge on TikTok at the moment. So your book's being compared to The Secret History. What elements or tropes of this genre do you think you kind of incorporated into your novel? And does it come with a pressure to be kind of put into this box, and particularly as a debut, to kind of have these comparisons or kind of genre expectations?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think it is tricky. It definitely comes with its own expectations, but I'll concentrate on the tropes thing first. Like, I think there's loads of tropes in dark academia, and also just kind of coming of age, although it's not really coming of age novel, but I love that idea of like the misfit. They come, they meet this like enigmatic group. We've seen this in books like Brideshead Revisited, that there's like a kind of idea of class, and I love all that. And I love that often it starts with the kind of good times, the kind of times where it's intoxicating and amazing and everyone's having a brilliant time, and then you get the darkness, and that's just like so fun to write about. And that's why I can see why, we as writers, people keep returning to this idea. Also why people keep returning to the kind of elite institutions. They're these kind of it's not a kind of closed door, murder mystery Agatha Christie style, but there is something kind of closed off about a campus. My book isn't set on a kind of traditional campus like The Secret History, but it does have that idea of, you're just kind of closeted in this kind of elite world, and the outside world feels really far away, which I kind of love. That's again a really fun thing to write about. But yeah, to come back to the expectation thing, yeah, I think it is quite tricky. The thing with my book is that although it's kind of got elements of dark academia, it's not got tons of academia. It's like almost like dark academia light, if that's a term. It's quite a dark book, but it's almost like instead of going down the path of the kind of elitism of academia, they choose like a different route in kind of entrepreneurialism. Is that a word? Entrepreneurship, that's the word. So yeah, it's like my own take on the kind of tradition. But yeah, it is tricky. There's so many amazing books, like Babel that came out last year. So it is tricky, but there's lots of different takes on the genre, I think.
Yeah, perhaps it leans more on the darkness than the academia.
Yeah.
It is always hard when there has to be kind of comparisons. And often I think when people are writing to agents and they have to pick kind of comp titles, it's really difficult, particularly when there's that pressure to pick a recent book and say, my book's like this. And really it's more about vibes than it is necessarily about the plot. And I think I would definitely say that your book kind of fits into that vibe, because there's a definite sense of dread throughout. And, particularly when we meet characters like Tabitha, you're just like, this is bad, this is gonna get worse. And I think that kind of whole group dynamic, I think, as well in your novel.
Yeah, like the group thing's really interesting. I was about to say, I think obviously Donatart does it amazingly, but just writing about the group is so fun. The kind of interactions of a group and the kind of little niggles and the little kind of bits of tension in a group. It's like, it's just so fun to write. Like, I quite like writing one-on-one scenes, and obviously I think they're easier to write in some ways, because you're not trying to kind of coordinate this big cast in a room all doing different things and saying different things. But yeah, they're like, for me, the funnest scenes to write if I get to do like a dinner party with like five people, that's like, for me, the most enjoyable in terms of writing. So I don't know if you'd agree with me. I don't know, as writers, we're sometimes drawn to the things that we just enjoy writing. That it's like Absolutely. A pleasurable experience. You know, it's quite self-indulgent, but sometimes it's like hard to stay away, isn't it, when you're just like, I just really like writing this like specific kind of type of scene. Even though it might get cut.
So one thing we have to talk about then is the prologue. And obviously prologues are a bit Marmite. I love a prologue. I know.
Controversial.
So did you always kind of intend for the prologue to be the beginning of the novel? And or was it, did you intend for a prologue and plan for it to be this scene? Tell us how it came about.
Yeah, so it was actually the first scene I wrote. So it was like, I did write that scene. I did write it kind of chronologically. It was interesting because the prologue is the only part of the novel that's not written in the first person. Yeah, I mean I have like mixed feelings on prologues, I think. Like, I do really like them. I like them when there's like a kind of circularity to the book, that there's a prologue. And obviously I think prologues and epilogues are like quite really, really quite common in kind of psychological thrillers now. It's quite rare maybe to see a psychological thriller that doesn't have either. I mean, they do exist, but they're obviously quite common. So I think they're really tricky. I mean, especially the epilogue in the book, that has changed so much, because it's so hard to write an epilogue and, you know, fulfill the kind of contract you have with the reader of it being tied up, but not too tied up, but kind of lots of dread and, you know, answer some questions, but not all of them. So the epilogue was really hard, but the prologue was actually, I think, in terms of the book, it's probably one thing that's changed the least. There was someone right at the beginning who was like, maybe you should ditch the prologue or like move it to a different bit in the book. But it's definitely been the thing for me that I was like, no, I think the prologue needs to stay.
I loved your prologue. I thought it was kind of really gross and horrifying and dark and also quite surreal. And I mean, I think the thing that I enjoy about prologues, which maybe other people don't enjoy, is that when you first open a book, you're not sure about who you're going to read about or where the book is happening or what's happening. A prologue is usually quite vague in a sense, but I find that enjoyable. Like, I really enjoy that feeling of, I don't know what's going on, I don't know who this person is, but I'm just you have that feeling that you're going to find out later in the book, and I think that always grabs you, I think.
Oh, I totally agree. That's what I like about it as well. I guess that like, you have to kind of use that part of your brain that like takes the prologue and kind of parks it and then is kind of return, you know, you have to kind of sometimes return to it. And usually if like, I feel like when prologues are done well, I don't know if my own prologue does this, but usually with prologues, like when you're reading, you're reaching back with a part of your brain thinking and trying to tie it, like trying to kind of latch it on to the main narrative. And that's just like a really fun part of reading a book, I think, is trying to tie it all together yourself and seeing if you can. And then when it clicks, it's like, can be the best feeling ever, can't it, when you're reading a book and it all comes together and you're just like, oh, that's how it all fits. I love it.
So let's talk about the kind of gothic influences in this novel. Obviously the Edinburgh setting really, really helps with that. And you chose Edinburgh because having lived there, it was a kind of obvious thing for you to write about. How important was it then for the city to kind of help you layer this atmosphere of kind of the dread and the gothic nature of it.
Yeah, I mean, I love Edinburgh. I just think it's a brilliant city. I've lived around Edinburgh for ages now. And I think it just lends itself really well to the kind of gothic nature, the architecture. But also when I was writing, it's tricky. I wanted it to be to show that kind of dual side of Edinburgh can be like this most amazing city, but it can also be have this kind of dark intensity that can be quite disturbing, and it has a lot of different sides to it. And also how someone who's not from the city and who arrives there, how they treat the city is so different. So how a newcomer treats the city and takes it in and interprets it. So yeah, no, it was a big, using Edinburgh a lot was really important to me. Edinburgh's great. Although I have had some people say, you know, maybe Claire's impression of Edinburgh isn't the most flattering, which is true. You know, she has these kind of this mixed relationship with the city. In some ways she loves it and it's like an escape, and she appreciates the like darkness to it, and then it kind of turns on her and the weather and things, and she kind of starts to hate it, and that's kind of part of the plot. So
let's talk about Claire then, because you've chosen to use a first person point of view in this novel. Was that decision because you kind of wanted to play with her reliability as a narrator and kind of hold her secrets a bit closer to your chest?
Yeah. And again, I think maybe some of this is just to do with the kind of genre conventions as well. I find like quite a lot of the more towards the thrillers are written in first person. I just really like writing first person. Maybe not even a stylistic choice for the book. I just really enjoy writing first person, and I really enjoy reading first person. Although it's interesting, with a close third person can feel quite like first person, can't it? But I maybe wrote the first chapter in third person, and then just very quickly was like, no, it's got to be first person. And with my second book, I've actually done the same thing. I started it. I was like, no, I think I'll write in third person, started it. And I was just like, no, it's got to be first person. So I don't know, maybe I'll wean myself off first person. I also quite like writing like just one point of view again, because I know when I was thinking about it, obviously it is very popular to have different points of view and kind of flip between them, but I quite like writing one point of view as well. But I don't know, it's tricky, isn't it? I don't know what you think about your own writing in terms of the things that we just feel very natural, and it's hard to kind of change your craft. I'm not sure.
I love first person. That's the kind of natural voice I think when I write, although I'm not writing in first person at the moment. But funnily enough, it wasn't until I started writing that I found out that people have very strong opinions.
They do.
One of my friends, her mum, answered to me, oh, you know, your book's coming out, is it written in first person? And I said, yes. She was like, oh, I don't read books written in first person.
Yeah, people definitely have strong opinions. Like, people have very strong opinions over like present and past tense as well. Like,
yeah,
so
I mean
it's really interesting.
Speaking as a reader and a writer, I love it all. Like, I can't imagine being put off by a book just because of those kind of choices, because I kind of think it's fun to have the variety of
definitely
and tense. And yeah, I think often when you start writing, one or the other comes naturally, although I have made massive changes in my first book about tense and not perspective but tense, and but I really like writing in present tense. So
yeah, definitely. And yeah, you're definitely right. I think when you're writing, sometimes some things just do feel natural and you're like, I don't quite know why this tense or this is working, but it is definitely working. But I'm the same with reading. I think different genres as well have different, it's more common to read certain tenses in different genres, and that's pretty cool. So yeah, I don't really have a preference.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So let's chat about Tabitha. She is one of the most fascinating characters in this novel. I really want to know how you kind of built her character and how did you make her so magnetic and charming, because she manages to persuade people to do some pretty dark stuff, pretty devious things. How did you create Tabitha?
Well, yeah, so I really liked writing Tabitha. She was so much fun, and I think I wanted aspects of her to maybe be somewhat relatable, but I almost had to kind of be like, right, she doesn't have to be likable. She's not going to be likable, you know, necessarily. But the reader still needs to maybe see why she's so appealing. But I think with Tabitha, part of it is like, the big vision. It's like, it's really exciting. I find just generally in life, like there's something really exciting about like speaking to people who have like a passion. And it doesn't really matter what it is. If someone's like absolutely so into something, that for me is so appealing. For me, that the whole appeal of Tabitha was supposed to be that, you know, if someone's got this vision and this kind of unrelenting revision of what things are going to be and this amazing idea, that can be like so magnetic, almost like a kind of cult leader. So yeah, no, she was loads of fun to write.
How on a practical level then, was it more that she just... the more you kind of wrote her, the more you got to know her, or were you doing kind of, basically I want to know more about your kind of craft. So are you one of these people that kind of does all those kind of character questionnaires, or was it a more on a kind of, I don't know, a less kind of structured way? How were you kind of coming up with her personality?
Yeah, so I am someone that like doesn't do any character sheets, or like I don't really even plan. There was like a really good quote from like Erin Kelly on a course I did ages ago, and I won't remember it exactly. It was something like this. It was something about the fact that if you like, and I don't actually know if she's a big plotter, but she'd said something like, if you just write and you kind of get to the end, or get halfway through or two-thirds through, you find that you've kind of left yourself kind of bits in the first bit that you end up pulling back in without even knowing. So you've kind of just like left yourself a weird event or a strange going on, and you leave these tidbits for yourself and you pick them up. And that I think that's so true. Like if you're not a planner, I think you can end up just leaving stuff, and then you're like, oh well, I put that in, you know, four chapters ago, not really knowing how I was going to tie it up. But actually that's perfect that that happened four chapters ago. But I think the issue around that is I don't plan. I then will do like multiple drafts. But that's for me is the most enjoyable part. So for me, editing is like the best part of the whole thing. So I love like structural editing. I really like line editing. So I just kind of bash it all out and then spend a long time kind of just changing it around. But I really tried, because I feel like writing in the thriller or suspense genre, it's probably a lot more helpful to plan more, because they can get quite complicated with timelines and stuff. But ultimately, I think I'm never going to be a big planner. I remember writing, when I was writing Things You Know, Friends, I had to go back and do a big spreadsheet and plan in, kind of work out what age they were at, like what times. And it was all kind of having to kind of retrofit, you know, all these things, because I hadn't ever done a timeline or ever done a kind of, you know, what's happening off screen. But that was when having like my editors at Penguin were really helpful in kind of making me do those things. And it is obviously a helpful thing to do, but ultimately, I don't think I'm ever going to be a planner. I don't know. Do you? Are you a big planner? I'd love to.
I am now, and I thought I was, but then for the Sea Women, it changed so much, and I ended up kind of not. I always knew what the end was. That's always been something that I always knew what I was working towards. I just didn't exactly know how I was going to get there. I'm like you though, hundreds of drafts, and then I'm a big fan of the editing process as well, and I love doing that. I'd rather be doing that than
me
doing
too.
The first draft. I hate doing that first draft stuff.
Me too.
I'm doing at the moment, so I'm not, you know, it's not in the place yet.
I totally agree. It's like fixing it in the edits is like really gratifying. But having, yeah, when it's just like fresh paper and no words, and you don't know where it's going, that's like the scary part. Yeah, I think also, like, for me, that's the way that I build the characters, is just like writing and writing and writing, and they do stuff and then I take it out and they do other stuff and I take it out, and you know, and then that's how I have to just build it. But I think it's pretty cool when people do character sheets and stuff. I do wish that I could get myself into that kind of vibe, so maybe I will in the future.
So one of the themes that I wanted to talk about was friendship, because that plays such a crucial role, and how you sort of explore how friendship takes different forms. And one thing I thought you was really interesting is that your title, The Things We Do to Our Friends, is kind of mirrored in the end in dialogue with Tabitha herself, because she kind of rolls her eyes at one point and says, the things we do for our friends, you know. And yeah. I liked that kind of contrast between that dialogue and the title. So I was wondering, like, were you interested in exploring the ways that friendship kind of can be toxic, almost, and dark, and in almost the way we think about toxic relationships? We don't often talk about toxic kind of friendships. So was that something you were interested in looking at?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's interesting you said about the title. So originally the title wasn't Things We Do to Our Friends. I didn't query with that title. I think I queried with A Cruel Friend, but I really like The Things We Do to Our Friends. I'm glad that it stuck, because I know a lot of people's titles do actually change on publication. And the reason I really like it is that, like, verb, like, I love the things we do to our friends.
Yeah.
It almost has like a little bit of violence to it. Yeah, I'm really fond of it, of that thing. And that's the kind of, I guess, the theme of the book. Like, ultimately, these people end up doing things like to each other, not, you know, that are not particularly nice. I think toxic friendships are like definitely becoming like more and more common in books. I've read loads of books recently, I think, where with toxic friendships kind of at the heart of it. And I love reading about kind of toxic friendships, because also friendships are so interesting, and they can be so intense, and they can be so complicated, and as complicated as and intense as kind of a romantic relationship, I think. Yeah, I just find friendship really interesting, especially at that age. So the book kind of is set, you know, it goes back, but also is set when Claire's like 18. And that's like a really interesting age as well, where you're, you know, finding who you're going to be, who you are, who your friends are going to be. So yeah, I think, like, for me, it's, I guess, especially writing like book two as well at the moment, you start to realize the themes that you can't stay away from, and you're like, am I just going to rewrite the same book? but there are some things that I'm just like, I feel like I'm always going to write about friendship, because I do find it really interesting.
So when I was planning to ask you these questions and I was writing my questions, I found at the back of your novel some book club questions, and it was very tempting to just ask you those questions, because it was kind of interesting to dig into the plot of the novel a bit, but I resisted. I was wondering whether those questions were your input into the book, or was it your editor that decided to include these and wrote the questions?
Yeah, so no, they were all my editor, and I've actually got, there's like separate questions. I think they're different in the US. It was actually really funny when my US editor sent me over the questions. I was like in a rush, and I didn't like read the email properly. And I just thought he was getting me to answer the questions. And they were like, you know, like, what do you think the contrast is, the relationship between this character and this character? And I was like, oh God, started answering them. And then I was like, oh, no, they're not for me. I need to answer these. These are for the back of the book. So that was funny. I didn't have any input into those, but it was interesting seeing them, and it gives you another perspective on things of like how people would interpret the book, which is always interesting, isn't it? People have these questions, you're like, oh, I have thought about that a long time ago, but I kind of forgot that aspect of the book.
Yeah, it does make you have to, you know, I'm sure you'll get asked these questions when you do kind of book club interviews and stuff, and then you will be like answering an exam on your own book.
Yeah, I'd probably fail.
So I want to ask you how long it took you to write this novel, kind of from first idea to kind of completed manuscript that you gave to your agent. Did you have a kind of feeling when you started writing it that this was something that had legs, or was it more you were just kind of writing for your own enjoyment?
At the beginning, yeah, definitely just for my own. I think I really wanted to see if I could finish it. I don't know about you, but when you're writing, it's like it's almost like writing just like 90,000 words just takes, so it's just like a marathon, isn't it? It's like you have to just keep going. And I really wanted to prove to myself that I could like write a whole finished thing once I started. And then it was just like, I wanted to write something that I had to write things that I enjoyed writing. And that's why it's, you know, stuff about writing group scenes and things like that. You know, it was very much, when it came to the editing process, obviously I kind of did a lot more work to make it potentially less self-indulgent in terms of just, you know, you make it more, you write about things you want to write about, and then you're like, no, but you know, the plot needs to do this and this and this and tick off these boxes. So it's hard to say exactly how long it took. I had an idea for it, and then it definitely took like a while to get the first draft, and then I queried for quite a while before I got an agent as well, and it changed because I did a revise and resubmit for someone before I got my agent, so it changed quite a lot. And I did the Curtis Brown creative course, again changed a lot during that course. So yeah, it's hard to say exactly how long it took from, like, because they had, you know, the ideas also were quite a while ago as well, like many years ago, so I'm not sure there's an easy answer. And then I was editing it once it was bought for a long time, because it was bought in like February 2021 and it'll be out in January 2023, so there was quite a long edit process. So yeah, quite a long time.
So tell us then your journey to getting an agent. So you said you queried, were you just kind of finding details of agents that you thought might be a good fit? How did you eventually find your agent?
Yeah, so I used the writest, is it called the Writers and Artists Handbook? I think it is. I think that's a really good resource. Like, it's got like some really good like essays in, as well as agent details. It's like, yeah, I'd always recommend that to people because I just think it's a really good resource in general. I use that. It's also quite nice having something just like physical as well. Like, so much is online that you can go down a real rabbit hole. So it's quite nice having something that, you know, has it all laid out. So I was querying it, I think I started querying it maybe at the beginning of COVID, but I wasn't really getting much kind of traction on it. I still think it needs quite a lot of work. I ended up doing another Creative Brown course, and that was really helpful. So that was the 3-month one. I ended up getting a revise and resubmit request from an agent, and their ideas were really great. They had some ideas that really helped. Definitely, and I really agreed with, so I was like, you know, even if it doesn't work out, these are like really good suggestions. So I did that, but then we were like in COVID, so it was, you know, things were just very up and down, weren't they, and difficult. So I was kind of waiting to hit back, and nothing was really happening. And then I actually saw online that my literary agency that I'm now with, spoiler, were doing a they were doing like, so they used to do like in-person pitch events, like around like in non-London cities. So I think they did one in Manchester or something. But in COVID, they'd moved this online. So it's basically an opportunity to, like, you sent them your first few pages and your query letter, obviously. And then, you know, if they selected you, you'd get to pitch them on Zoom. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. It'd be good. It'd be nice to have the opportunity to kind of sell the book as well, because you don't usually get that opportunity, do you? It's all on the written word. So anyway, so I ended up entering that, and I my now agent, Emily, she liked my pitch for the book. And then I sent her the full manuscript. And then she made me an offer. And there was one other agent who was interested as well, but I went with Emily. So that whole thing, that whole process, the process of querying was quite long for me. And then on the other side, the submission was actually pretty quick. So it was like a few weeks or maybe a month.
Oh, wow.
It was a pretty quick submission process. But I think it just depends. I speak to so many people that have a short agent bit and then a long query, long submission. I think so much is just depends, doesn't it?
And what about your in-between time? So from when you signed with your agent to when you went out on sub, were you doing a lot of work with your agent?
Yeah, so we didn't actually do a huge amount of work. I mean, we did do an edit. It was probably a month.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, that's very fast.
It's hard to know what's. It's so interesting as well.
Well, I say that. I mean, everyone has such a different experience.
You don't know what. Yeah, I don't know what's fast or what's slow. So yeah, it's really interesting you say that. But so we just did. We did some kind of structural changes, but yeah, we didn't kind of like totally gut it. And I think she already had some like ideas, obviously, about who to submit it to, and who would kind of be interested in what their kind of. She was like, they'll have their own changes and stuff, which they did. So yeah, that bit was quite smooth. So yeah,
I'm interested to hear what, if you can remember, what you were kind of asked to change and then resubmit.
One of the things was to include Edinburgh more.
Oh, okay.
So it was like, really bring Edinburgh to life more, and I think that was like such good advice because although Edinburgh was in the book, I think I did want to bring it. I think I did want it to feature heavily and to be really ingrained in the novel, but I maybe just hadn't had the confidence to kind of slow the pace and bring the city in more. So sometimes you need someone to tell you almost, don't you? Like, it's fine to do a bit of description and not, I think it's really tough. I think with thrillers, pacing is like, I speak to a lot of people who say it's hard to get pacing right. Mm. Because, it needs to have a certain amount of paciness, but then you also kind of want to build an atmosphere in other ways. So that was a big bit of advice. So that was great. And I did do a lot of work on that.
I wondered whether you could kind of share some secrets or advice from your time in kind of this early publication phase. And I'm thinking about people who are maybe going to debut in 2024 or people who are maybe hopeful that they might get a book deal this year or an agent this year. I want to know what you think has been the most challenging part of your publication journey or what you've kind of learned or had to deal with. And how have you dealt with it?
I think like reviews are really tough. So like I think I thought that I would be able to like not ever read reviews and it's just not really been possible for me. Like I need to read them. And like, I think it's like, I know we've spoken about this before in terms of like reviews aren't for us as authors, they're for the readers. So, it's not for me. I know that, but I still read them. So I think reviews can be really tough, What I would say is I think this is not like me making this up because I know people have said before, but things like, if you get a good review, maybe like think about printing it out and literally putting it somewhere. So, because it's so easy to focus on the bad ones and the people that didn't enjoy it. And if you've got that kind of visual, representation of the good reviews, then that can really like lift your mood because, it is tough, isn't it? And then I'm always just like amazed when I read interviews with authors and they don't read any reviews. And I'm like, I wish I could be like that. So like my advice would be like, if you're able to not read any reviews, like amazing, like try and keep that up forever. Just don't read any reviews and you'll be so happy. But the other really good one is when you go on your favorite novel and read the bad reviews, like the one star reviews of your favorite novel, then you're like, okay. I think that's actually a really good cure, and I have done that before when I'm feeling down. I'm like, okay, well, people didn't like this book, so it's fine. What else? I mean, yeah, just like patience. Like it is a long, I'm sure you found the same, it's like a long kind of, it's a marathon, not sprint, and you just have to kind of be very patient, and sometimes that's not very natural, is it, when you just kind of want to get on with stuff, but there's not much you can do, you just have to learn it. But I don't know if I'm getting better at being patient, but I'm trying to be.
One thing with the reviews, and I don't know whether you'll find this, but I found that I was the same as you at the beginning, and I couldn't stop reading them, and I knew that it was a bad thing to do, and I still did it because I was just naturally curious, and because it was almost like a bit of a novelty, because you know, no one had read it apart from me and my agent and my editor and, you know, copy editors and stuff. I just wanted to know what other people thought. But then I reached a certain point where it may be because I read a bad one, and then I thought, actually, I've kind of had enough now. I've kind of got my fill of feedback, because I've read loads of nice ones that are saying kind of similar things. I know now what people think. And I, if people aren't going to like it, I know why they don't like it. And actually, you don't need to read five reviews all criticizing the same thing to realize that's what people have picked up on. And I wonder whether you're obviously really, it's really early on for you, whether you'll feel that you'll get to, I don't know, March, and you'll think, I don't need to read them anymore.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I've heard loads of other people say that, of that, like, it's really hard at the beginning, you read all the reviews, and then you're able at a certain point to be like, I've had enough data almost. Like, there's no more data to give. Like, I know why people don't, exactly. I know why people don't like it. I know why people like it. And I think for me, it's just reminding myself that the reviews aren't for me. You know, these people aren't writing reviews for me to read. They're for other readers. And that's, like, totally fair. So I try and remind myself of that when I'm reading them, and just be like, well, it's not for me. You know, I'm making the decision to read this. You know, no one's saying, no one's forcing me to read them. So
unless they tag you, which is
unless they tag me. But then it's, like, so nice when you get a nice review. That's like, so enjoyable. So
finally, are you able to tell us if you're working on anything new at the moment?
Yeah, so I've kind of finished writing a draft of a book two, but it's not a sequel. So same kind of genre, psychological suspense, thrillery kind of, you know. It's a more kind of like toxic wellness kind of cults, kind of that kind of thing. I'm just kind of waiting on that. So we'll see.
Well, that sounds good.
it's yeah, I don't know if it's good yet, but we'll see. Fingers crossed.
Well, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast today, Heather.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Heather Darwent talking about her psychological suspense novel, The Things We Do to Our Friends, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.